The Jewish labor movement in this country has been widely recognized as an immigrant phenomenon. The associated institutions of that movement, the trade unions, press, schools, parties, and fraternal orders, were all founded by immigrants, led by immigrants, grew up with the immigrant tide, and conducted their affairs in Yiddish, the language of the immigrants. Of all these institutions, only the needle trade union unions were able to transcend their immigrant origins and transform themselves into viable organizations serving the economic and social needs of a wider membership. Even in so doing, these unions have not lost their essential immigrant quality, for they now serve the needs of a newer immigrant stream, the Negro entering into an urban, industrialized scene, and the Puerto Ricans taking his first hesitant steps into the vortex of mainland factory life. This process of transformation of the unions from an immigrant phenomenon into stable social and economic institutions has hardly received the attention that it deserves. It is the purpose of this paper to examine the experience of the Jewish unions in this light and possibly to suggest a hypothesis for more detailed testing. Most students of the Jewish labor movement agree that the organizational impetus for the formation of unions among the Jewish working men and women came from the young, idealistic, socialist-minded students and former students who migrated to this country during the last two decades of the last century. For some time, these young people were leaders without followers, for their organizational successes were short-lived and temporary. Professor John R. Commons, writing of this period of needle trade unionism, recognized the militancy of the Jewish workers, but spoke disparagingly about their constancy to trade unionism. The reasons for this phenomenon are not hard to find. Both the potential leadership and the potential rank and file misread their roles in this movement. The leaders, transposing almost without change their European experiences to the new world, hoped to use the unions as an educational and agitational forum for the purpose of converting the members to socialism and achieving the classless society. The members, on the other hand, looked to the unions only during times of stress, usually at the beginning of a new model season, to gain for them higher wages so that they would be able better to achieve their major aim, to rise from the ranks of the needle proletariat. These attitudes are not difficult to understand, given the experiences and the living environment of the principals. To the young idealists who received their first political and social impressions in the hothouse of Tsarist repression, and whose world had been circumscribed by the narrow confines of either the shtetl or the newly emerging industrial city in Eastern Europe, the aims of organizational activity naturally tended to the apocalyptic. Reform in the Tsarist context was not possible. Halfway measures bred compromise with evil, a compromise with which tyrannical officials refused to condone, and thus conspiratorial necessity led to utopian desires to transform society root and branch. Physical transplantation to the growing Jewish centers in the United States did not readily transform this view at first. Living in cocoon-like isolation from the rest of American society in a ghetto environment, these young idealists fed upon each other. Their world was bounded by the geographical limits of the Lower East Side of New York, and whenever they penetrated the outside world, it was usually in the company of like-minded young men of the socialist or anarchist movement. Furthermore, these men were more attuned to the agitational than to the organizational dimensions of their task. They spoke to the masses after first learning the tongue of the masses, aroused them to strike activity, but failed to convert the strike enthusiasm into solid organizational foundations. The more able among them did not remain long associated in leadership positions of the young, immature, and unstable unions. More important to them than the United Hebrew Trades was uniting the socialist political movement or personal business or professional ventures. Thus, young Morris Hillquit moved into the political arena after a short sojourn in unionism, and Joseph Barondes moved into insurance and eventually into Tammany politics. As long as the leadership potential of the Jewish labor movement remained isolated from the economic needs of their potential constituents, and so long as this leadership remained ignorant of the American social and political differences from their East European experiences, so long would the Jewish unions remain unstable, impotent, and ineffective. The common workers in the ghetto shops and tenements were moved not by socialist messages or by visions of a bright future of equality and justice, but rather by their desire to escape from the shops into business or professional world. Their concern was for better pay so that they could bring loved ones to the new world, or so that they could accumulate a small stock of capital to enable them to enter into the ranks of subcontracting entrepreneurs. They migrated to the new world not only to escape tyranny, but also to improve their economic and social conditions. The socialist message fell on barren soil with them, for socialism would preclude the possibility of achieving the status aspirations. Many memoir accounts relate the manner by which families assisted their members in gaining an education, enabling them to escape their proletarian status. One such account told of three brothers, two of whom were slaving away in the sweatshops at the turn of the century, so that the third could attend the city college and become a lawyer. After which, the lawyer brother enabled the others to follow in his path. At the time of the negotiations leading to the settlement of the 1910 cloak strike, Abraham Rosenberg, the president of the Ladies' Garment Union, commented that almost all of the negotiators on the other side of the table had been workers in the trade at one time and had even been activists in the union. The instability of the needle trade unions up until the end of the first decade of the 20th century tended to perpetuate and to reinforce these tendencies. Lack of organizational stability prevented the development of a stable leadership bureaucracy, and consequently, the union leadership could indulge itself in the luxury of ideological conflict. The press, the street corner, and the local meetings, when held, were the forums used to convince the audience of the righteousness of the Socialist Party, of the Socialist Labor Party, or the anarchist path to the promised land. Almost all the Jewish unions founded during this early period included statements of the class struggle in their constitutional preambles and asserted that their major aim was the achievement of the classless society. Only the Hebrew Actors Union failed to include such a statement in its constitution, a function perhaps of thespian individualism. The United Hebrew Trades, created in emulation of the short-lived socialistic Labor Party's German language trade union organizing body, served to reinforce this tendency among the intellectual leaders of the Jewish labor bodies. Its major function was to assist in the founding of Jewish unions and in the recruitment of Jewish workers into the labor movement. Since, however, this body did not have to deal with the daily practical problems of any single trade, craft, or industry, its activities were directed largely to the political and ideological conflicts of the day. Thus, the United Hebrew Trades was used as a lever, to gain control of District Assembly 49 of the Knights of Labor, so that Daniel de Leon would have a base of power from which he could attempt to capture control of that declining labor body. Similarly, the United Hebrew Trades figured prominently in the socialists' attempts to gain control over the American Federation of Labor and in their anti-Gompers campaigns. The rhetoric of the class struggle was aimed in these efforts at the ideological opponents within the labor movement, and the bulk of the rank and file Jewish workers remained indifferent to the heated polemics. Had this remained a static situation, the necessity for studying the Jewish labor movement would not now exist. Changes in leadership attitudes, the qualitative change in a minority of the newer immigrants finding their way into the ghetto garment shops, and the growing concern of a frightened Native American middle class with the untidiness and social exploitation to be found in the sweatshops and quasi-sweatshops slowly transformed the Jewish unions into viable institutions. In the process, there was a slow but steady move away from the implications of the irresponsible class struggle on the part of the leadership of the unions and a growing desire to work toward a resolution of the production problems of their respective trades in cooperation with some of their manufacturer counterparts. Ironically, however, as this process continued, a small minority of the rank and file nostalgically regretted this turn away from militant class consciousness and sought to prevent any further class collaboration. In this crucible of internal struggle was fused the many elements which converted the Jewish unions into the pioneers of social responsibility and trade union methods and made their influence felt in the wider labor movement. It is this process of internal and attitudinal change which placed the Jewish unions in the forefront of the mainstream of the American labor movement that I call the Americanization process. The ideological consequences included a move away from the imperatives of the Marxist categories and a greater awareness and concern with the practical solutions of complex industrial and employment problems. This transformation was opposed by doctrinaire intellectuals, by emotional rank and filers, and by local union officials who felt closer to their activist followers than to the national leaders of the unions, and who believed that their own powers would be diminished by the necessary centralization of authority that the new practical approach required. When the dust of battle cleared after over two decades of sporadic internal wrangling, the synthesis with neither socialist class conscious unionism nor the vulgar economism of Gompers' policy of more, but rather an amalgam of social responsibility for the working men taken from the former together with the practical concerns for bread and butter issues and job control taken from the latter. This then was the path taken by the Americanizing Jewish unions from emotional, rhetorical socialism to socially responsible pragmatism. Behind the dynamics of the transformation of the Jewish unions were many varied and diverse forces. The process itself took different forms with different unions, but for sheer dramatic interest and for its importance as a pathfinder in this process, the experience of the ladies' garment workers is instructive. Chartering of the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union by the AFL in 1900 did not immediately change the pattern of organizing futility in that industry. The union leadership remained isolated from America and from the American labor scene despite AFL affiliation. Shop strikes ushered in each season, but between seasons, the workers in the industry remained indifferent to the rhetoric of the union leaders. The proliferation of small shops, the irregularity of employment, the constant turnover of the labor force, and the apparent helplessness of the union to cope with these problems precluded mass membership. In frustration, the union leaders intensified their socialist rhetoric, cursed the lack of class consciousness on the part of the worker, and sought greener fields to harvest in political activity or in the press. Thus, Benjamin Schlesinger shuttled back and forth between the Forward and the union during those frustrating years, and although Morris Winchevsky attempted to work within the dress local, he continued to earn a living by penning proletarian verse. Morris Hillquit and Meyer London felt that building political socialism was more rewarding than trying to organize the Jewish workers, and except for occasional monetary contributions to the union during times of extreme distress, they remained distant from its activities. The unsuccessful 1905 revolution sent a stream of disillusioned militants who had gained revolutionary and union experience in the rising textile centers of Eastern Europe, into the ranks of the Jewish garment workers. Their ears were better attuned to the socialist and trade union messages of the union leaders, and their revolutionary experience led them to expect positions of leadership in the American movement. It was this group which gave a membership stability, no matter how small, to the struggling local unions, and with it, an appreciative audience for the leadership's rhetoric. These new arrivals were not an unmixed blessing for the future development of the union. Although they conscientiously and self-sacrificingly gave of their energies and talents to build the union, they also served to reinforce the class-conscious mentality of the vocal minority of the rank and file, at the same time that forces were at work to increase the effectiveness of the union by forcing it to emerge from its Marxist straitjacket. The great strikes of the shirt waist makers in 1909 and the cloak makers in 1910 signaled the beginnings of stabilized unionism in those industries and began the education or re-education of the union leadership. The wide publicity and support from the so-called better element of society which these strikes engendered was for some of the union leadership the great breakthrough into the outside American world of the then simmering progressive era. Much has been written regarding the essential anti-immigration bias of a large segment of the progressives during the first decades of the 20th century. But regardless of this bias, most middle-class reformers felt an obligation to assist the immigrant in avoiding the pitfalls of an industrial society. Although some blamed the immigrant for boss control of the cities, most felt that the immigrant should be taken by the hand and carefully escorted into the main parlor of American life. Private social welfare, education, and in some cases, the stimulation of industrial democracy through unionization were combined by these middle-class reformers in the settlement houses located in the heart of the immigrant sectors of the larger cities. Fearing that the unregulated chaos of exploitation of the immigrants could result in further deterioration of the promise of American life, and with it the loss of their own significance in society, these middle-class progressives were drawn to the immigrants' own self-efforts at organization. Not surprisingly, then, the strikes of 1909, 1910, and 1913 in the ladies' garment industry attracted the support and the sympathy of these reforming men and women. To the majority of the leaders of the union, the interest, sympathy, and help of the prominent socially conscious citizens was indeed eye-opening. Not only did these activities go counter to the simplistic class conceptions, which were held as almost articles of faith, but the attention from the most distinguished people was to them ego-satisfying as well. In a way, the aid of a Mrs. Belmont or Mrs. Harriman and the concern of a Feline and an Abbott served to open a way out of the restricting confines of the immigrant community for the national leadership of the Union. How different from the Tsarist experience was the sight of former President Theodore Roosevelt on a dressmaker's picket line in 1913, and how different the efforts of the Bureau of Labor Statistics of the federal government in trying to understand the industrial and employment problems of the immigrant garment workers than the knout and the Cossacks attack. The benevolent intervention into the affairs of the union by important Jewish communal leaders was better understood. After all, the conflicts within the industry were conflicts largely between Jewish workers and employers, and the efforts of the Kehillah and persons such as Louis Marshall and Louis Brandeis could be seen as attempts to prevent these internecine conflicts from fanning the flames of anti-Jewish feeling in the non-Jewish world. Yet, their efforts resulted in the settlement of the 1910 strike and an attempt to work out a system of permanent mediation between the antagonists, which in principle denied the class conflict theory and enthroned the practice of worker-boss cooperation for the mutual benefit as a dominant idea within the socialist-led ladies' garment union. The reluctant willingness of the union leadership to accept this protocol of peace idea stem not only from the fact of its prominent sponsorship, but also from the realization that the permanent existence of the union depended upon some degree of employer recognition of collective bargaining, and this the agreement provided. Unlike the earlier days, when small shops almost exclusively dominated the ladies' garment industry, by 1910, larger inside shops controlled by a small number of manufacturers overshadowed the smaller ones. The possibility of standardizing and regularizing employment practices existed, and the necessity for hiding practical impotence by revolutionary rhetoric diminished. Characteristically enough, however, the leaders continued to talk to their members in terms of the class struggle, while acting on the basic premise of union management mutuality of interest. A new spirit began permeating the ranks of the national union leaders, a spirit which has been best reflected by John A. Deitch, the secretary treasurer of the ILGWU. Deitch, whose socialism had been tampered by his short English sojourn, where he came under the influence of the Fabians, attempted even during the heyday of disorganization to gomperize the Jewish labor movement. He felt strongly that practical improvements for the worker could not come until the latter had learned trade union discipline and had discarded outmoded European conceptions of class antagonism. Businesslike efficiency must be introduced into the union, he felt, and extraneous, that is, non-industrial questions had no place in the labor movement. Deitch distrusted intellectuals and, although the Forward was seeking pretty much the same ends as he felt that the Kahn influence in the union was a destructive one, if for no other reason than the Forward was compelled to perpetuate the socialist ethos among the union members in order to maintain their loyalty and readership. Deitch, through force of personality, was able to pull the then president of the union, Abraham Rosenberg, the plain cloakmaker, along with him and his ideas, and thus was able to dominate the activities and the attitudes of the ILGWU during the first 3.5 years of the era of the protocol. For the first time in its history, and for the first time in the history of any Jewish union in the United States, a stable mass membership was acquired. The preferential union shop principle, which was written into the protocol, made it attractive for workers to remain in the union ranks, and thus for the first time, the union officials were faced with the necessity of developing efficient business methods for handling the affairs of the union. Deitch, as secretary, was responsible for developing an accounting department, a mailing department, a union labor department, and for supervising the activities of the union's clerks in the protocol arrangement. He and his associates were responsible for operating a large and complex organization, and in so doing, developed a sense of bureaucratic ownership which they jealously guarded. Slowly but definitely, the pendulum of prevailing practice swung away from socialism to business unionism in the ILGWU. But this tendency did not go unchallenged. The class-conscious militants among the rank and file condemned the protocol and all it stood for as a retreat and a class collaborationist surrender to the enemy. The leaders of the local unions, who depended upon the rank and file for support, condemned the centralization of power and authority in the hands of the national leadership. Deitch's dictatorial methods alienated many who otherwise supported his objectives. To Abraham Kahn and the Forward, Deitch was going too far in the direction of, quote, pure and simple, end of quote, unionism. And furthermore, the advice of the East Broadway people no longer had as much influence in union headquarters as before. The socialist professionals on the periphery of union affairs, men like Meyer London and Morris Hillquit, were engaged in a struggle within the Socialist Party with a left-wing syndicalist led by Big Bill Haywood, and thus, even though they were not completely happy with Deitch's leadership, they agreed with the basic principles of the perpetual protocol of peace. Within the ranks of the union professionals, however, Their attitude was known and not so clandestinely reported to the dissatisfied members. To make matters worse, the constitutional heads of the ILGWU, in cooperation with the peacemaking mediators Brandeis, Henry Moskowitz, and A. Lincoln Feline, had oversold the protocol as a panacea for all the industrial ills of the ladies' garment workers. Their public statements suggested that a new era of ethical industrial democracy had been inaugurated by the protocol, at the same time that the flaws in its machinery were causing increasing discontent among the workers. The tensions of transition from ideological to practical unionism during the era of the protocol were reinforced by the unrealistic attitudes of the practical trade unionists and by the efforts of the moderists who became chief clerks under the arrangement to gain for the garment workers the full measure of benefits coming to them. Discontent among the workmen brought about by changes in the organization of production had no legal outlet. The mediation machinery was slow and uncertain. Strikes were outlawed by the protocol arrangement, hence the discontent flared up in unauthorized shop strikes. The socialist rank and file accused their leaders of selling out and of converting the union into a scab agency. Particularly among the cloak operators, many of whom were recent graduates of the Bund, did this feeling persist. The object of their scorn was John Deitch, and he reciprocated their feeling. He called these workers, quote, a undisciplined, kampflustige mass, whose power can only be a powerful evil. Instead of talking to them of democracy and industry, what is necessary is for someone in authority with influence to shake them by the collar and tell them that they must first become a democracy and cease to be an undisciplined class struggling mass, end of quote. The conflict came to a climax when Dr. Isaac A. Horwich, acting as chief clerk for the clockmakers, attempted to revise the protocol machinery so that effective arbitration would replace the non-functioning mediation. He further sought to limit the spread of sub-manufacturing, which was making a mockery of the union standards guaranteed by the protocol. Opposed by the leaders of the ILGWU, he was supported by the militant rank and file of the cloakmakers, and when the manufacturers, with the enthusiastic support of Deitch, sought to eliminate Horwich as chief clerk, civil war broke out in the union ranks. Interestingly enough, however, the issues of the conflict were no longer the issues of the late 19th century. The Americanization process had gone so far that the debate was not over the question of whether the union should work together with the manufacturers, but rather how they should work together. The rhetoric of the debate changed as well. The major rallying cry for Horwich and the young militants was arbitration and enforcement of the protocol, whereas the opposition shouted that discipline and diplomacy were the major requirements of the hour. In the end, a compromise was worked out, largely through the good offices of Morris Winchevsky and Abraham Cohen, whereby the major antagonists were all eliminated from leadership positions in the union, and some minor structural changes were made in the bargaining agreement. The protocol period, then, was the tension-ridden time of troubles, which marked the transition for the union from isolation to full participation as an effective American social and economic movement, having roots strong enough to serve the needs of the garment workers for years to come. Out of the struggle between socialist dogmatism and pure and simple economism, eventually came a new synthesis which enabled the union to serve the full-bodied needs of its members. Concern for their education, health, welfare, and attempted participation in the wider political struggles making these objectives possible marked the difference between the approach of the Jewish unions and that of the traditional business unions of the AFL. But before this new synthesis became a firm reality, the union had to undergo many internal conflicts similar to the one around the protocol. For each generation of the new militant workers had to experience the process of transition. and this continued until the last of the Jewish immigrant garment workers had been through the fire of internal conflict. I think we can only actually discuss Mr. Sherman's paper because Mr. Rishon has left and I'm not equipped to answer for Professor Berman. Are there any questions for...
I'm perfectly willing to forego that too.
Huh?
See, I'm perfectly...